Hi, welcome to On Writing, your fortnightly podcast on online writing communities and the terrible advice they give. My name is Sean.
We could call it very bad advice.
Oh, no. I thought we had gotten all the bears out of our system earlier. No,
the bears are forever.
We're three Californians. We are the bear.
No, we can never aspire to be the bear.
No, we are the bear. That's why we can't rid ourselves of that beautiful Gavin Newsom.
Beautiful Gavin Newsom. Yeah. No, though that this episode is funny if you listen to the other podcast and
they're like, I'm starting to think I figured out Chad's kinks, and they appear to be really weird, high-level American political romances.
Yeah, it's the executive branch. That's it. So today we are talking about reads. My name is Sean. He, him. I think I said that one already. Go.
I'm Chad. He, him.
I'm MJ. She, her.
And there's this thing that we've been talking about, like themes that you gotta, that you don't have to be like, well, what's your story really about? And you need to like have that super locked down. And if you don't feel like your story is like about something, it doesn't matter. But because what your story is about can often emerge out of it. You should have some ideas of the things that you want to play with, right? You shouldn't just be like, and then he'll use his lasers on the dragon and then the dragon will die, right? Because that's what differentiates like a...
We've established that the first thing you have to establish, it's a binary. Shoddy either will or not do him like that.
but yes, that like the why things happen and like the universe that you're portraying should have meaning beyond the mere sequence of events that happen. Right. This is what art is. Right. I think we can say. And that even shit that we don't like as a podcast, like latter stage Marvel movies, fucking the Harry Potter books, especially the later cash-in-y ones like Fantastic Creatures and Cursed Child, these things that we don't like, we still say they're like saying something, right? And that you should aspire to like get something under your tires, right? Get some traction beyond, again, the Wikipedia summary of the events.
I mean, don't let it be like J.K. Rowling racism. Like, that's not what the something is.
Yeah, don't let it be anti-Semitism. Because
I love how deeply that goes, because, like, there's so many levels you could peel back on that. The understated racism that appears in that. Because she's all like, of course I didn't explain it. Jews being greedy speaks for itself. I just have to identify the Jew features.
Yeah.
And everybody will be on the same page. It's like, how much have you normalized this?
Like, again, it's like the Shakespearean level where you're like, I didn't realize it was anti-Semitic because so many people say it. It's like, yeah, no way. That's crazy, bro.
Is it possible you may live in an anti-Semitic culture? What? No, we didn't even fucking chase out our last rabbi.
Yeah, we didn't even invent anti-Semitism. That's fine. Like, have you looked at anything Churchill said other than, like, the one speech? No? Okay, cool. That's fine. We're going to leave that as it lie. Do not look up things Winston Churchill said.
If you really like living in the same world where you enjoyed the Power Rangers movie without doing any postmodern attachments to it, just don't read what anybody said except, like, the highlight reels that would appear in, like, We Didn't Start the Fire.
Poor Billy.
This will just open pathways into your brain that can't be closed again.
And ruin a bunch of other things, including a bunch of like conventions and stuff, depending. But yes, that's actually what we're talking about. We're talking about bad reads, not just reads of like, my God, did you know this thing was about anti-Semitism? Because there's a lot of anything written by a British person, you should like go in expecting a little bit of anti-Semitism. And the only way China Medieval gets around it is by being too weird. Right, that he's
oh no, he invented frogs to hate instead. He's all little frogs, you will bear all of the aggro usually reserved for the chosen people.
Yeah, but then again, like, dump, like pissing furiously on Grim Nebulin is in fact a relatable act, so I mean,
yeah,
who can say whether right or well, right?
That okay, this is going to get a little esoteric and sound like it's in defense of hatred, but it isn't. It's a little more abstract than that, that can help you with your writing, which is a lot of people are uncritical in their racism. I know that sounds like a shocker, but dig a little deeper on that and realize how uncritical they are in their racism. And realize that what they have is basically empty slots for fears and anxieties of certain things. And culture has just passively informed them that X is the avatar of those fears. The issue is that, like, those people aren't. They're just trying to go do their thing, right? But yeah. Shani Mayville understands, and a lot of really good genre fiction writers understand that, like, you don't have to include a coast of head-shrinking cannibals, because that's a specific slight against a specific group of people in order to justify the fact that, you know, people wanted what they were sitting on.
Yeah, we're sending a lot of gunboats to places with rubber trees and on account of, I don't know, just fucking, I read it in a book once, okay?
And the, but the people are still legitimately scared by what that represents. So you can invent something new that completely justifies those fears.
They don't need to abstract them. Also, they don't. This is the thing about fantasy racism, that every time they're like, and then they just met them and they talked about it and they realized that people aren't so different after all. It's like, holy shit, you are the dumbest. You have never been around someone ever, right? Because like the whole notion is like authentically racist people can immediately muster up the one of the good ones. That shit's always like a moment from their lips, right?
God, that film. That film that I keep telling you to watch, Conspiracy, that's just the 12 Angry Men of Genocide. There's a part where the Nazis are sitting around how they're going to get around that. They're like, okay, so we're all in agreement that the Holocaust is cool and we could probably sell this, but everybody's going to have their one friend that's the exception. And they have to like put aside how they're going to tackle that issue.
Jesus,
so,
yeah.
Right. So, yes, racists are very good at that. And like, I'm going to speak from the other half here, by the way. Let's say a dwarf meets an elf. They're not all going to Legolas and Gimli out, right? And we're assuming here the traditional status quo, the dwarves and elves don't like each other in this particular case.
No, I mean, I think the thing is that dwarves are full of like wisdom and kindness and determination, and elves are horrible and must be cleansed. That's my official position. Chad's strongly anti-dragon. I'm strongly anti-elf.
Elves are full of, oh, you're still talking, are you? That's wonderful. And then they walk off mid-conversations. The dwarf goes, so what the fuck was that all about? No, if the dwarf deeply hates the elf and he meets the elf, all the only hurdle you've overcome is proximity. There's still a million ways that people can hate each other. So as the dwarf is talking to him, if the dude is like tonguing his gums a little too much because he has a toothache, the dwarf is all like, yeah, elves would be assholes like that. That makes sense.
True facts. And again, agree. I agree. I strongly agree with that premise.
But what's also interesting is that this is interfacing literally very differently between racism and fear, right? So like, well, isn't it racist that they fear orcs? Well, no, because orcs like only eat sentient things and try to burn everything. So you should be afraid of that.
Yeah, my corollary with that would be that is getting into like the distinction between like a Tolkien orc and an everyone else orc, because
no,
everything
that's true.
Since Tolkien has had the orcs be like just dudes, and there's not like an abstract reason to have them be like the enemy of God. But I do want to get us back on
how much. Well, I was just gonna say real fast. They varied based on what type of person the author wanted to seem like.
Yeah. No, actually, yeah, that like, and this is kind of a part of a thing that if you want to do the evil doom thing, you need to do the doom. You can't have them be just guys.
Yeah.
So that
congruency brings us to is very important.
Yeah. So that brings us to our actual topic, which is like shitty reads, which is where you read something and then you immediately hop on Reddit and you say, I think this book is about this. And that's like the apex read where that you say the whole thing. The whole thing's actually just an allegory, and anything that you find that's exterior to that allegory is actually not real. There's nothing there. And there's a few books that this applies to. Some of them are significantly allegorical. So like the works of Faulkner can be read as broad allegory for like American political concerns. As I Lay Dying is famously associated with economic policy. But your high school English teacher did not probably afflict that on you because
you know what? You're right. A Flower, is that what it was called? A Flower for Emily Rose was actually an allegory about how the IRS won't stop fucking you even after you die.
Okay, yeah. It's about estate taxes. No, I don't think that one's actually about estate taxes.
No.
Yes, the idea of carrying the dead body along for like a purpose that it's serving something is about that kind of like depreciary economic policy. And if you look into the book, there's a lot of and the other works of Faulkner, especially Sound and the Fury, there's a lot of other moments of economic or fiscal policy in play, right? Like investments and debt structures and all that shit. And so it's much very clearly legible, especially when you look at like Faulkner's letters or Faulkner's other publications, right? And you can construct a reading for this. However, this reading isn't As I Lay Dying is about the economy. Okay. What else do I need to say? Because that reading does take like 95 pages to construct, right? You really have to fucking start drilling down. And if you don't have 95 fucking single spaced pages with the adequate footnotes to do it, you can't like mount that reading. And I'm not trying to mount that reading. I'm just trying to describe it. You can't
mount that reading on the church door, those 95 opinions that you have.
So the first category of bad read is obviously the it's about the thing. And obviously that's wrong because with its 95 theses, because there is only one Holy Mother Church of Rome. And that's no joke, kid. And this is the biggest thing, because this is most readings, right? Most readings that you see on like r/books are like, yeah, it's actually all just one allegory. I mean, it's like obvious, bro, when you like look at it, bro. It's like, okay, no, you really have to do more work than that.
You know what's also funny is that they have a tendency to create a distinction between, or no distinction between allegory and this author probably agrees with me on things. Mm. Right? So like the amount the author agrees with you is the amount that it's an allegory, because I strongly believe that the source of this quote unquote read is last somebody else that disagrees with me, and therefore they quantify allegory with an eloquent way to say something that they agree with, and anything else is the closest term for it would be propagandistic. Mm-hmm. Because that's how they're registering what allegorical works are.
Yeah, that they're trying to convey a specific set of ideas rather than tell a different story, right? That this feature that undergirds the thing, these themes, readable elements, the symbology, that was the whole purpose of it, that it's designed to subliminally deliver these things. And that by you not accepting them, you're not just like failing to accept my reading and my work. You're like negating the author, and you didn't even read the book, right? Which is like also true, depending on people who, you know, have not read the book, but is kind of out of bounds either way.
Well, which is also robbing them distinctly, because we've talked about all the different ways you can read something as in, you walk into a movie with a certain set of assumptions and see where those conclusions lead you, and you can change the assumptions every time. And it's kind of like using different types, styles, and intensities of lights to investigate a crime scene, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you walk in and you turn on the allegory light and it's just like a flashlight, you're like, yep, I'm sure there's like no hidden blood or semen at this crime scene, and then you walk off. Like yeah, you robbed yourself of all the other things that could come out of this.
Yep. And I think one of them, and I'm going to fucking seamlessly transition here, would be illuminating with moonlight, which is very useful. It's very helpful for walking around at the dark, as I believe Master Commander has emphasized that the Aubrey Maturin series, that the sun ain't no use at all because it's out when it's already bright, but the moon is out when it's dark and is therefore more useful. But of course,
this is why the Byzantines in the early 4500 BCs loved the moon goddess.
Yes, but that's fake and propaganda, Chad. That's actually an Orientalism you just said, because Marjorie, I think you were the one who told me this. The moon was invented in like 1740 by an Englishman, right?
You know, it was that Keats guy. Like, it's only we didn't have any poems about moons until the British Romantics. Now, I'm being sarcastic. Obviously, we had poems about moons, and lots of people wanted to fuck the moon for many, many years and put that shit in verse and published it. But there has been this again, like this has come back around in my circles of the poem that is attributing moons and flowers to the British Romantics, which is totally ignoring the fact that like the Brits went to different places and stole their flowers. That's how British gardens got to be. And they're like the famous Arabic works of like the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam is about roses and rose gardens. You know, but yeah, no, this is the worst take that like it's only British dudes, only in the British Romantic period did we decide to write about flowers and moons.
And it's also like a meta read, right? Because it says what is essential about English poetry comes from England and is like flowers and moons, where I would say the fundamental unit of like English language poetry is like martial poetry. It's like Charge of the Light Brigade and fucking Dulce Decorum Est, right? Pseudo-Latinate like praise of the military and anti-praise of the military, that this is what it's structured against. But it's like, no, they invented the moon, and to be counterculture, I am not going to talk about the moon, right? That it's both a read of another poem demonstrating itself in a poem.
And it's like, and they're using it to discuss like oppression and like how awful it is to not be able to see the moon because you're in prison. And it's like, okay, are you saying that no one has ever like talked about this before? Like above all else, like I am sure several other people who love the moon from like hundreds and not millions, but like obviously like thousands of years ago.
No, I'm like, pretty sure a Stegosaurus was all like, that moon fucking rocks.
Yeah, I'm thinking like a T-Rex like looking up mournfully at it, right?
The T-Rex and wants just being to fuck like, the moon what? Too.
Yeah.
I want to see MJ's Jurassic World. This is a crossover between one of my liches and that T-Rex meeting and going, we'll get there one day, buddy.
We'll get there one day, bud. Any day now. We just got to do it. We got to hustle. Yeah. No. And this extends far beyond the moon, because it also goes to the conventions of like rhyme and meter, where it's like these are things that were invented by the monarchy. It's like they for sure weren't guy, right? These were fucking stolen. This is all
Elizabeth sat around all day going,
did you know you could rhyme with seven syllables? Issue an edict on that.
Well, I mean, you think about what fucking British like monumental culture is, and it's like, oh yeah, it's like the Winged Victory and the Babylonian Gates and the fucking Parthenon marbles, right? That it's like, oh no, they just jacked everything. What part of their culture do you think is entirely indigenous? Like, it's dancing around a circle of upright rocks, okay? That they get, and even then you gotta run it through a little gardener sieve, right? But the idea that there's like anything that you're breaking free from a monarchical or Anglican like vibe by like decrying the moon and stuff, or decrying rhyme, decrying meter. These things are all like, no, actually you aren't. You're just, you've failed.
I also didn't get to inject my good moon read compared to everybody else's bad moon reads. And it's very topical because it's, in a game called To the Moon, which is honestly more of a novel than a game. The bad read is that there's any significance at all. There's a plot hole. Why didn't they just come out of their whole journey and tell the old man, get over it, dude? It's just a rock up there. Anyway, die well. Significance? Dude, that's not even moonlight. That's reflected sunlight. Jesus Christ.
Oh, God. I think, are there any particular poems that people, I mean, that's another one, is like Charge of the Light Brigade is seen as like pro military, when it's like, no, it's actually there's, and like Dulce Decorum Esque is fucking satirical. It's saying it's not sweet and good to kill yourself for your country. Actually, that's not true. I mean, poems, their very nature is that they can be inherently read in negation to themselves, right? If their meaning is obscure. So,
yeah. Well, I think what a poem means and what it represents depends on who put it on the most pages and circulated it in their curriculum.
Okay.
And because West Point prints a lot of it's a sweet and seemly thing to die for one's nation. Well, there it is.
There you go.
Evolution has been hijacked by the intelligent design of the Pentagon.
Poetry is when Semper Fi, that we recognize, right?
Look, they just saw Dead Poets Society and they're like, that's all we know about poetry, Dead Poets Society.
I pressed my fist up against the post. The Navy shit. It's a Navy shit. That's what's happening. Like, we're like boats.
Well, ask anybody that's been in boot. 90% of their job is poems about how to, like, clean the head. that's because in America, we raise a better class of soldier. We don't just raise soldiers. We raise warrior poets.
That would actually, okay, now I've just been fully fucking, I'm off the rails. I'm like, okay, what if the U.S. Marine Corps was in fact raising warrior poets? What then? What then, guys? Holy shit. Fuck this warrior monk shit. I want them to be whimsical. I want them to have scarves, right?
Yeah, no, this, I don't know. This all occurred to me one day while watching Full Metal Jacket, and they said that Ho Chi Minh is the son of a bitch. I've got the blue balls, the crabs, and the 7-year itch. And I went, oh my God, they're warrior poets.
Fuck. Fuck, I think that goes to my bad read, because one of them is talking about the author alignment thing. And like, this is about classism in the works of Brandon Sanderson. So like, Brandon Sanderson wrote the first Mistborn trilogy, right? Way, way, way back.
It wasn't the first. What about the second one?
Yeah, he did also write the second one. That one's also.
He doesn't stop ever writing them.
This man must be stopped.
He's written two books since we've been recording this one singular podcast episode.
Yeah, and like five TikToks about like, thank you for reading my book. And I'm like, fuck you, Brando.
I know why the Mormon church set him on fantasy writing. It's because he kept trying to write more golden plates.
Yeah, literally. He's like, I'm just carving them up, dude. And they're like, but the angel Moroni said only the chosen could see it. And he's like, I can see him pretty good, bro.
He's like, ah, grab those two rocks over there and get reading.
Get hacking them up. Yeah. So the first one has like the first book of the Mistborn series has a very like liberatory thing. They've talked about it as like anti-establishment Ocean's 11, that they're doing an Ocean's 11 with wizards against the God King, the God Emperor, trying to steal his immortality and stuff. And I'm like, that rules. And then the second one, they've replaced the God Emperor and then are trying to administrate like the post-apocalyptic society and sort of reassemble it. And I'm like shortening it very significantly because this is a whole fucking trilogy and about a trillion things happen. But what happens is, after being rebels, they assume the role and then they're like, gee, ruling is hard. And it's all these obnoxious like rebels who are trying to rebel too violently against us. We're trying to get to their concerns, but we can't get to their concerns fast enough. And, oh, gee, it sucks that they're trying to rebel against us.
So right? how much of this was clearly written because he just finished playing Fable 3?
Like a lot, kind of. I don't think this would. Don't maybe explain Fable the worm. 2, right? Yes. There's an Inquisitor. I think it's fine. I'm thinking a lot of Dragon Age too. But the thing is that the guy they appoint to be like the God King that they like elect is like also a noble, like a hereditary noble. And it's like, no, actually the Divine Right of Kings is bad. And he also kind of reconstructs some Divine Right of Kings, like chosenness in Stormlight. And people are like, no, he's not like constructing that there's like a Divine Right of Kings. And it's like, oh no, he fucking for sure definitely is, right? That he's like, ah, the racist structures of the fucking the world are bad, that light eyes should not rule over dark eyes and there should be dark eyes liberation, and like the slavery thing is also bad. And then they have, when the fucking people get the magic swords good enough, their eyes turn light, that it's literally a sign of being descended from fucking people who are like bonded to magical power. Right. And it's like, oh, okay, I get it. But it also fucking puts aside a lot of monetary concerns because he disjoins like class, race, and like this kind of social class at the same time. And he addresses this later in shit, like in Stormlight, the book one of Stormlight, and Marjorie can testify, there's a lot of it and it's really boring, is that shit is so expensive and it sucks so bad being poor. I hate being poor. I hate not having money. And then Dalinar rolls up and I have like, I have $1 trillion. Would anyone like some? How much could a banana be? 2 emerald bromes? Right?
You know, that, like, you actually just made something click in my brain, which is that I almost gave up on Brandon Sanderson when I first started reading Mistborn because I didn't like the first 3 pages of Mistborn. Like, and not just all like, oh, this didn't hook me. I read them and I went, God, I really hate this.
Yeah. I mean, it's got like the worst opening line of like any book. It's like, right, ash fall on the roof. And you're like, that's not good. That's not a good one.
Right. Well, and it was the slave master looking around at all of his slaves going, look at all of those fuckable chickens. Right. And because what it is it's laying on so heavy. Every trope of bad taskmaster possible that I'm like, oh, I mean, like, I know where this is going to go and I'm not going to like the journey. Like, you can call yourself like an independent franchise, but you're just sending somebody up the street to buy some McDonald's stuff and sell it here, guys. Come on.
Yeah. And it does improve past that point. But like, it's
interesting. The connection that I made is that this is related to a conversation we just previously had. The reason I didn't like those first couple openings, because that's not the broad strokes of what Brandon Sanderson writes. That's the goddamn fucking Dalinar chapter of that book.
Yeah.
I hate
this Dalinar chapter.
Dalinar's chapters are such a, like, you're like, can we please go back to Yasna? Can we please go back to Yasna? Like, every time I
hear more about that slave trader that fucking owned what's his name? Who's Galadin? Just all like,
the
dude that's just all like, so you throw the map. Okay, well, I guess we're not going to have an epic bonding like I thought. Anyway,
I thought we were going to be bros. Oh, well. He's got the tuberculosis. I do not care. Yeah. But yeah, so like that whole book is like kind of correcting and amending shit that he had, like, I don't know if he had specifically received, but he had mentioned receiving this as feedback in the thing about like specific class concerns and having like abstracted money away in the Mistborn books. And like, it shows up in Stormlight a lot that it's like, here's a lot of fucking class issues. And it's like, you can compare them and see that one is reading like super class blind, where it's like, it's cool being a wizard and just kind of abolishing class with one wizard attack. And then the other one being like, oh shit, it sucks because I'm a wizard and there's all this class structure I have to move around it. Right. And all his later books play really heavily with this, where they feature class, because some of his worlds are like fully post-apocalyptic or like post-scarcity, right? That there's no longer like a meaningful gradation of class and wealth in that way, right? And that's one of the advantages of fantasy, is that if you don't want to have a world with class, you don't fucking have to. But there's a whole lot of reads that are like trying to be like, no, he's actually doing like secret double subversive class shit with like Elend Venture being like the guy and having to put down rebellions against him. There's actually like another level, not a proletariat or bourgeois, but a secret third thing, right? It's like, no, you don't have to like fucking try and construct like a whole apologia to say like, look, the first book is like easily the weakest of them. The prose gets really good and they're very, very fun. And the later ones, I love the magic system. I love the books. I love the characters, but it is weak on class. I'm not fucking grading it on whether it's weak on class, right? I'm not like fucking taking a star off because it doesn't like sufficiently address fantasy class dynamics. Because on God, fucking Lord of the Rings doesn't address fantasy class dynamics at all. Or where it does, it's like, you know what? Maybe it's cool that there's a king who can order you to be put to death, because if he's a good king, he won't order you to be put to death. And that's what matters, right?
Ooh, the dilemma of authority.
Yeah.
Like, are you a good person because you've never ordered somebody to die? Have you ever been in a position where you can make that choice?
Werner Herzog has, and he chose not to flex it twice. Yeah,
even though he maybe should have at least once, I'm thinking. Like, I don't know if the fucking Mesoamerican tribes people come out and are like, we have found a demon in him, we will kill him for you. I think I'm like, you know what? Apropos of nothing else, I think I accept that reading, right? Like, I don't have the best demon detectors. I've never fucking sniffed something and smelled a demon. If someone,
I'm gonna cut deep on this one. I left my stud finder back at the hotel.
God, the part in the fucking Mother God cult where they like hold up the EMF meter to the dead body, that shit ended me. I was like, gross, 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 gross. No, don't do that.
I
like,
thought Sean was gonna die when I made that stud finder comment.
Yeah, fucking hell. But yeah, I think I just want to bring up one more and then I could send it to Chad to bring us through the fucking rapids on this one, over the mountain. We'll carry this boat over the mountain to go full Werner Herzog. And that's Lolita, because it is not pro-pedophilia. It's anti-pedophilia. It's strongly anti-pedophilia. And if you read it as being pro-pedophilia, or it any way being anyone's fault other than Humbert being a huge piece of shit, you are doing it wrong. Because like every page is like, wow, Humbert is a piece of shit. How did you not grasp this?
If you read Lolita and you like somehow come out on the side of Humbert, or you think that like this is in any way an articulated defense of pedophilia, then you know what? It was a bad year last year, but I hear guided tours of the Titanic are coming back, and that sounds like it's up your alley. You should go give it a try.
Hell yeah. Yeah, the boat's carbon fiber. It's got, they'll even let you steer it for a while. It's very cool.
It's so easy, they can use an Xbox controller.
Yeah.
But this allows me to illuminate, for instance, why this is an episode about more than just bad reads, because you can always find bad reads. Go look at somebody. Okay, actually, throw a dart at any comment section about The Last Jedi, and you're going to find a bad read. mm-hmm. on every side of the scale. This to me is about red flag reads and toxic reads, and that's kind of what we want to examine here. And the allegory thing is kind of a toxic read, right? Where a toxic read is when you are deliberately shaping the read to express something that you want it to express, right? The biggest, easiest example, the parallels to all of this is that there's a lot of people, you've seen them online, that come out in defense of the Grinch and how the Grinch stole Christmas. And they're like, we're a bunch of noisy neighbors being loud. You'd be grumpy too. Guy just wants to enjoy his silence. Okay, so that's a red flag read, right? That's a red flag read. That's not toxic because you didn't change anything. It's a red flag because a bunch of people like getting together and doing things, and they don't. And because of his behavior, they don't invite the Grinch. And it turns out you side with the person that doesn't get invited to things. That's telling about
you. I mean, it also, like, critically, the whole premise is that Whoville does believe in the true spirit of Christmas, that they do have they love Jesus a lot, even with no presents and no whohash. They're whohashless, and they still love Jesus, right? That's the whole thing. So, like, the Grinch is wrong, right? Like, he has misapprehended the fucking spirit of Christmas.
Because really, right. It's about capitalism. This is the read here. If you want to be a Grinch or a Scrooge, you have to be anti-capitalist. Like, this is just how, like, well, I don't make the rules.
The fucking Who's are anti-capitalist. They don't fucking care about the present. They're like, yeah, it's fine, right? Like, I'm good, actually.
A bunch of Americans have had their brains contaminated, and they're like, no, to be a Scrooge, you have to be Scottish. Hello.
Yeah, though there was one fucking read that, like, actually Scrooge was good because, like, he wasn't wrong when he said, like, he is the one who gives the fucking mice a job. And in this, I'm categorically only using the fucking Muppets Christmas Carol. I don't accept any other Christmas Carol. Okay, Scrooged, maybe. Scrooged, maybe. It's on thin ice, though. But, like, he actually does give them their job, so they do owe their houses to him. And it's like, okay, no, hang on. No, okay. How do you have to fucking do, like, a Mountains and Rivers read of Charles fucking Dickens? The man was not subtle. He literally is like, this is the theme. I think it's bad, right? They're like, well, oh, especially the because greed I did in life has forged my chains in death. Right?
Like, well, especially, yeah, the book about, if you only give a shit about money, you're going to live a lonely life, right?
And die. Like, and die. Yeah, memento mori.
Yeah, yeah. You're not exactly busting down academia with new and innovative reads on that. But in addition to that, like, you're putting way more thought into it than Charles Dickens did, who is just all like, oh, right, I do owe them that tomorrow.
Chuck need that money. Chuck need that money. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's a red flag read where what you read is revelatory. And I think that this Lolita one is a red flag read. Well, it makes a good case for, you know, Jeremy Irons' character. Why does it make a good case for him? What is your search history? Why aren't you allowed to post on the Something Awful forums anymore?
Ooh.
Yeah. How psyched are you about Elon Musk owning Twitter? Like, just to be clear, right? How much is, like, oh, total freedom of speech? Like, we're not going to moderate anything. How important is that to you as, like, a day-to-day basis?
Now, rather than just saying it, though, are there any examples that you can think of in can you give us a taste of why Lolita meets your thesis? Is beautifully written. Hates Humbert.
Yes. Okay. The biggest thing is that Humbert throughout the book attributes his actions to the seduction of the object of his affection, right? And you are to not read this as him being truthful because he's lying. He's just lying. He's an unreliable narrator. He swears up and down how he's telling the truth, but it's very clear he's not the whole time. And when he's saying that, oh, he's seduced and she was such a cute little pretty thing who, like, came onto me, he's deceiving you. And people are saying that this is true, that she is, like, mature beyond her years, or there is some kind of sexuality that transcends, despite the fact that she ends up, like, destroyed by the end of it, right? She's, like, non-personed and maybe killed, depending on your interpretation of the thing. Though it has been a minute since I fucking read Lolita, and I could be remembering a fan fiction unironically. Did I tell you guys about that fucking legendary Twitter post? Not Twitter post, Reddit thread, where someone was trying to find a different version of the book It, where it involves It at a summer camp, and it turns out to be a fucking It Supernatural fanfic, because the author of said fanfic shows up after the guy and his girlfriend were arguing about things that happen in the book It.
I hate this.
But yes, it's a kind of thing where, like,
actually, what you mean is Hugo Award winning piece of fiction.
Ah, yes, there was a Hugo Award winning piece of fiction regarding It and summer camps. It might have been in Onceler fandom. Who knows? Probably not Omegaverse. It was early for Omegaverse. But the premise is that, like, the beauty of his text is the only surface you have access to. You have no actual record of these lives lived. And the movie kind of, like, plays into the text as written as opposed to, like, the text as conceived, because Nabokov was always playing with these things. The narratology, right? Like, the reader, the implied audience, the implied reader, the narrator, the implied narrator, and the writer, right? That this structure, this pyramid that goes from, like, bottom to top, that you are reading Humbert Humbert's, like, deathbed confession of his actions. It's trying to justify him into the next life, that he goes to his death fucking guiltless because he's like, I didn't do anything wrong. And he's dead and no justice can ever be had on him. He can never be punished because he's dead, right? This is a critical presumption in Lolita that people forget. But this presentation is by someone whose only interest is in protecting himself. He has no motivation in telling a true record of events. And so people who assume anything that he says, anything at all that he says is correct, are just fucking, like, falling into the trick of beauty, because it's said multiple times, and Nabokov has said it a lot in regard to Lolita, that we presume that things that are beautiful are true, right? And that this is, like, the fundamental thesis of the book is that,
look, holy, I managed to make you fuck.
Sorry, go ahead.
Holy shit. That means that the best read is that Lolita has been lying to the cops the whole time because she is a fucking, because she's beautiful.
Yeah, because she's actually a 29-year-old, like, no, college student who, like, killed her fucking, yeah, like.
I'm hesitant to use this word while talking about Lolita, but we can go deeper on this.
Oh, no.
What I mean by that specifically is, if you take the parameters that you just set, would you say that there's a romance that exists between Humbert Humbert and Lolita?
In his own presentation, there right, is.
He in his own presentation. Is, yeah. Now, considering the Earth thesis of the novel is that what is beautiful is not necessarily what is true, or we ascribe truth to something that is beautiful. Isn't it an important read on this work that he blew right past any of her signs of reluctance or whatnot because he finds her beautiful and therefore he finds misleading truths in her too?
Mm-hmm.
There, good.
Yeah, I don't know.
Which you all miss out on if you think it's a topical thing about how creepy Jeremy Irons is, right?
I mean, he's
just as an FYI. Right? If you walk and you go, right, don't be Jeremy Irons in that movie, or do be Jeremy Irons in that movie, don't. But yeah. If, like, those are the only topical surface things that you take away from it, it's kind of like I was talking to somebody last night about people's obsession with, like, weird subversive Freudian cuckoldry, as weird as that may sound, but, like, if you take anything that has fathers and sons who don't get along, people jump right on the cuckold train.
Mm-hmm.
Right away. So like Tyrion Lannister in Game of Thrones, you get a shitload of people that are like, you know, my theory is that he's actually the Mad King's son, and it makes Tywin angry. But he raises him anyway because, you know, it's better that people don't realize that you're a cuckold. Like, they're so close to quoting Barry Lyndon, but they're not, like, media literate enough to know that they're about to quote, it's better to be thought of as a fool than a cuckold.
Mm.
Or is there to be thought of as a cuckold than a fool?
I think the fundamental thing, that, just to latch on the train that where you're headed, the thing that he said is that it is, in fact, not a romance between Humbert Humbert and Dolores, but between Nabokov and the English language, right? That's what he's writing it about, and the capacity of the English language to portray things that, you know, Russian could not portray, and that's why.
Lolita, what that means is that okay, I can't make that joke. Fuck it, I'll make the joke. Bleep it up if you don't like it. That means Nabokov saw America, and our language is young and fuckable.
Yes.
That's what he was trying to say. There's the thesis. Enjoy that.
Yeah. And a lot of fucking people like have noted this who work in translation have said this about the English language, is that it's incredibly inexact. You're very able to hide anything you're saying, that you can have you can make a sentence with zero valences, right? Whereas in like other languages, you have like a very limited set of them, or they all come with like a multiple set of meanings, right? That it doesn't have this vagary. It has multiple concrete interpretations as opposed to saying nothingness that English can do, while at the times also being exact. That's kind of what Lolita is, because it varies between this like exactitude and this diaphanous, mystical, artistic premise over and over and over and over again. Until you kind of like lose track of where you are. And then you're like, oh, right, he's a pedophile. I totally forgot.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and where I was going with the cuckoldry train is that what you're relying on is the satisfaction of a sudden subversion having like a Newtonian value that way exceeds what its actual value is. It's like, you thought thing was thing, but it isn't. That's a good story. When a rich story has so many new things that you can experience and dissect, that like look to see how deep the work can actually go. Don't just be satisfied at the first sensation that pops into your brain, you fucking weirdo.
Yeah. So I think that leads you to where you were headed, right, Chad?
I have two very different, or if your mind is fucked like mine, two very similar pieces of work for you. The first is Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and this is a big, noxious, toxic read. This is called the Fuck Grandpa Joe read. And if you are a connoisseur of
basically the opposite of Nabokov, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. or if the point of views were switched, I suppose horrifyingly similar. But I digress. Fuck Grandpa Joe theory hinges on this idea that, and we'll never get along if you hold this theory, that Grandpa Joe is a villainous character in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, because, and this is spoilers for the 1970s film Charlie and the Chocolate, or Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, to be precise, but also the book. Jury's still out on all the other Wonka things that they're abusing their copyright with. Grandpa Joe, along with, is it three other grandparents, are resigned to bed.
Yeah, it's because the whole clan of them.
Yeah, they have a terminal case of being old burdens.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of them just kind of lay there while Charlie and his mother go out and try to scrape a living that will support all of them. And the only person that has a serious no shit relationship with Charlie in the family is Grandpa Joe. And Charlie has this dream of randomly stumbling into the lottery and being able to tour a chocolate factory. And when like you put it that way, you start to realize how depressing the situation actually is.
Well, it's Dickensian. It's literally Dickensian, right? It's using the abjection of poverty to tell a uplifting or transformative story.
No, it's just also funny if you take out like the mystical elements and just look and be like, yeah, so like this poor kid works at a laundromat, and if he could think of one thing he wants to do, it's walk around a chocolate factory for an hour. And then he can churn infinite clothes.
Yep. He could go back to darning socks and like eating rats. You know, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. So. But that's a chance to fulfill his dream when these golden tickets are issued. Whoever opens a chocolate bar and gets a golden ticket results in you being able to go into Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. Now that I'm older, my pessimism is that this is actually a marketing scheme to dump unwanted taxable inventory. He's like, fuck it. I don't give a shit if fucking seven kids get to walk around my factory. These Wonka bars are burning through my wallet at $1.10 an hour. Okay? Get them off the shelves.
I would also point out that because the Oompa Loompas are in fact paid in kind with chocolate, he can only use the inventory value of the candy bars, not the full sale value. And that means he has tax deductions for his fucking ordinary business expenses is like zero, right? It's the whole thing where it's like, I make fucking refrigerator magnets and I need to work for 3 hours to buy one refrigerator magnet that I make. The Oompa Loompas are like, I do that times a trillion. I'm making a billion chocolate bars an hour. A gazillion, because it is in fact Roald Dahl, and so the numbers can get quite ludicrous.
And as everybody else sees the statistical improbability of pulling a golden ticket, Grandpa Joe is the one that says, well, buy a fucking chocolate bar. see what happens. And he even buys Charlie a chocolate bar. I mean, I don't really like know last, how, because he like can't.
4 cents or whatever.
Yeah. And, like, if you cannot already see that these are really big abstractions about how much Charlie's life sucks and how much Grandpa Joe loves him to try to do what expressions he can at the limits of his body, then I don't know what to tell you about being able to read the tone of a fantastical work. Mm-hmm. Like, if you haven't apprehended that, the fact that they fly into space in a glass elevator may be beyond.
Mm-hmm. It also goes horizontal, I would say. The fact the elevator goes to space is a lot less magical now than the elevator goes sideways.
Mm-hmm.
So Grandpa Joe gets him a chocolate bar because, in case you're too media illiterate, and if you hang out with the fuck Grandpa Joe crowd, you are. What he's bought for Charlie was not a lottery ticket. He bought him that feeling that there's an opportunity to escape doing laundry all day and being poor all day for just a few minutes until he opens it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's like what Marx, he wants.
Marx would say the golden tickets are the opiate of the masses, the conception of hope of some alternative from their proletarian existence.
Yeah, well, you know what? It may have been shot in Germany, but it took place in England. God save the Queen.
Well, no, we can't say that. We're losing our anti-British credentials here.
Yeah, but I'm pretty anti-communist, so I gotta do my part like I'm stepping on cockroaches for a camera. I digress. Obviously, the chocolate bar doesn't have a ticket in it. And there's some feeling of like, so Grandpa Joe, why'd you even do that? And he's like, so that the poor boy can have something other than dirty socks in his life. That's why. And he continues on. Charlie continues on. And by beleaguered chance, he ends up with one of the golden tickets. And he comes back home very excitedly to show his family. And Grandpa Joe sees it. And now that we understand, we appreciate the golden ticket is representative of a better life, what a grandfather wants for his grandchild, all of these types of things. Seeing that he actually possesses a golden ticket and can act like a child, he flings himself out of bed and follows him to the factory. And this is the part where people decide, fuck Grandpa Joe. Because the read that they get is that Grandpa Joe is a freeloader that's been sitting there letting Charlie do all the work, who could have gotten up at any time and gotten a job, but he decided to do so right now, only when he could benefit from it. Now, there is like nothing in the story that actually suggests this. This is very clearly a case of just like, here, joy heals all wounds. As we discussed before the episode started, Gene Wilder is Christ. He Lazarus'd those legs. That is the Valley of the Lepers. You he could
put
even
all take- those demons in those sheep.
You could even like take the read if you want that, like, literally or biblically, like time and age are leprous and hope is somehow curative in an almost divine way. And the other three have no hope, but Grandpa Joe has found hope in love for Charlie. And that's where the miraculous cure comes from. If you want to get like really deep on a fucking Roald Dahl story.
Charlie right. for Wonka and Joe for Wonka in him. Yeah. Again, we're I get so much mileage out of this with that fucking Milton quote. But
and,
yes.
And
I think the biggest thing about
so crass and cynical and like what you're trying to do is broadcast to people that people can't pull a fast one on me. I know what he's up to. Well, you know how you never have, you know how you actually show people can't pull a fast one on you? Don't take payday loans and don't play games of three card money at the dock.
Yeah. Also, like, hands in pockets when you're walking through a parade. I mean, just facts, right? But the fucking thing is that it's such clearly a mountains and rivers ass read, right? Where that you have like, here is the face naked truth of the situation. Like, Grandpa Joe is so excited that he fucking it cures his illness because he just loves chocolate a lot. Right. And then like level two, Grandpa Joe was fucking faking it. He was a fucking grifter making Charlie go to work so he could live in the lap of like luxury and laziness. This isn't a Dickensian. This is like fully Marxist. And the grandparents are the bourgeoisie. There we go. And it's like, no, idiot. Clearly they're not. Right. And then you get to like a fucking reasonable one where it's like the fucking chocolate bar is irrelevant. Chocolate symbolizes things. Right. It operates along these things. And it's like literally literally like a fucking MacGuffin, right? It's something that is sought for its own internal thing, right? That this magical privilege will be bestowed on you completely arbitrarily associated with this object. And it's not like the fucking golden tickets do anything, right? There's not like a barcode reader for them. It doesn't actually open a door. No,
there's a very, very bored Oompa Loompa with a scanner whose job is to make the scanner beep. And yeah, if it like does, that. And if it does, he activates the turnstile. If it doesn't,
all right,
he tells
keep the
you to
line
leave.
Moving, buddy. All right. Yeah, let's go next.
He's had talks with Willy Wonka, where Willy Wonka goes, Oompa, what is your job? My job is to vet who gets in here. Wrong. Your job is to let green names in.
Yeah. And like, I think a lot of these fucking reads are just mountains and rivers where they're like the obvious thing that happened. What if it was the opposite of that? It's like, okay, that's neat, but you do have to ignore every single other thing in the story to make that go. Right. Because if you do that fucking like the fucking r/understandingsocialism or whatever the fucking subreddit is, that's like every single day is like, I just discovered socialism. What are some good arguments that I can use to destroy capitalism? And it's like, oh, buddy, I think you should probably read State and Revolution and then go talk to another human being in real life about anything. Please. Right.
Yeah. And like, you rob yourself of so many other experiences, too. So you're either a mean-spirited curmudgeon and that's what one of the red flags reveals, or you're ignorant and you're robbing yourself of a lot of experiences, such as like there's a certain feeling of hope and a certain feeling of the possibility of comeuppance that there are people who try to use money to alter and change the variations of arbitrary randomness, such as Baruch Assault, and yet she gets in the exact same way that Charlie does, and Charlie walks away with a grand prize of as much chocolate as his dental insurance can afford.
And does not die critically.
Yeah. You know, Grandpa Joe probably pushed her.
Well, I'm just saying that fucking Roald Dahl was not afraid to kill a child. That's basically all his books are like, child murder dot wab, right?
Yeah, that sentence, Roald Dahl was not scared to kill a child, is really scary when you find out like what he was up to in the 30s and 40s.
Oh yeah, he was killing Nazis for real, right? So you can safely assume that his shit has an anti-fascist character because he had to fucking hose off the blood from his hands when he did that shit. I always love it when you find out like a beloved children's author was like, oh yeah, he had like a kill count in the triple digits. And you're like, what? Excuse me?
There are very advanced techniques that you can use in order to extract these types of, or like selective surgical reads. But like, if you're coming to the conclusion that Grandpa Joe is thus, then you're not ready to use those surgical techniques because you should be letting the work speak for itself rather than trying to be like, huh, well, if I take away these brambles, why would you take away those brambles? Mm-hmm. Those exist. Now, on the other end, this is. That was actually a toxic read. That wasn't a red flag read. I completely fucked up my thesis. Everybody forgive me and assume that I was being very toxic, because what you are doing is you are editing the core work in order to arrive at a conclusion that you want to be seen being held. The next one is the big red flag read. This is the red flaggish read of all time. You thought it was a red flag when your college roommate hangs up his imperial flag from Star Wars. This is a way bigger red flag, and he probably owns at least two imperial flags and one First Order flag.
I just want to point out that Roald Dahl was in fact a flying ace. He did land more than five Vichy French and Nazi planes. Just want to point that out because that's fucking crazy.
That just
Char
means
Aznable and Roald Dahl are in the same category.
Well, I was just gonna say that like that technically means that it doesn't perfectly overlap, but the Venn diagram circles of Roald Dahl and Porco Rosso just got an inch closer.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I feel like he could have written Porco Rosso. That would have been a fucking valid book.
It definitely would have been from Pippi Longstocking's perspective rather than Porco Rosso's, which is that would be a fascinating episode to get into at some point, which is like the mind of Miyazaki and how he approaches his craft and how perspectives affect the aesthetic and styles and themes of his work.
Well,
and
it's funny
how they
is that
theoretically.
Well, sorry, finish.
Well, how they could theoretically become akin to other separate films if you just change the perspective in that film.
I mean, of course, the biggest one being No Country for Old Men, because he's not going to fucking retire, right? He's like, I'm retiring. This is my retirement. I'm so sad that I can't do movies anymore. I'm just kidding. I'm back.
I was telling somebody that I don't like Cyberpunk 2077 as a theme because it's an uncritical regurgitation of cyberpunk tropes to sell tabletop books, and nothing sells that more than a yellow panic in 2077 where the Japanese take over the West Coast. Dude, you're just regurgitating memes from the 80s. Are you fucking kidding me?
You're like, nobody, my God, they have so many VCRs. Like, but the small reason functional cars.
The reason I point that out is because a true Cyberpunk 2077 reference should be that you find a newspaper that says that Miyazaki is coming out of retirement to make his final film.
Yeah. But yeah, Chad, you were saying on the true toxicity.
Yeah, the true toxicity. This will apply in all sorts of books that people read, but the apex, the alpha daddy of it, has got to be Bloodbraid.
Hmm.
And this all comes from this one comment that I read in a recreation of the judge's notorious speech, where he describes the nature of warfare and declares that war is God.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you read any of the framing about this and any of the prose in Cormac McCarthy's novel, you're supposed to look at this and go, oh my God, I thought he was feeling pretty alien before when he was like 8 foot of white. And I don't mean like Caucasian white. I mean egg white and shaped like an egg. If I didn't think he was alien before, this is it. This man does not operate on the same operating system as me.
It is funny because the judge is described exactly perpendicularly opposite to the xenomorph, right?
Holy shit, you're right. Isn't it funny that... No, it's really fascinating that you point that out, because I know this is a really weird unspoken sentence, but there is nothing sexual about the judge.
And he's anti-sexual, right? Like, that's the whole thing, is that he's in negation of, like, actual sexual relationships.
Well, down to the fact that he interfaces with sex in the novel, but he does so inquisitively. Like, it's not a concept that occurs naturally to him.
Yeah.
And he's all like, oh,
relationships operate along violence, right? So anything that he has that simulates sexual relationships are, in fact, violence, right? And that's kind of the conclusion.
Which is fascinating, because he is as different from a person as a xenomorph, but he looks more like a person, whereas a xenomorph looks so distinguishably not human, but is so much more sexual.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's just, it's fascinating how
it's made
how it landed on that.
It's just a million stacked up dicks. And that's another bad read. Is when I said that to someone, they're like, no, it's not. It's just made of like bug parts. And I'm like, you might want to look closer at those bug parts, my guy.
I see. You haven't been hanging out on certain parts of fandoms of the internet.
Well, I mean, you just zoom in, right? And any of the works of H.R. Geiger are like, yeah, that's like, we were watching fucking Rebel Moon. Holy shit. Worst. Mm. That show fucking sucks. Bad movie. I don't know what Star Wars is, but it isn't that. I would actually take Rise of Skywalker over Rebel Moon. No joke. It's that level of Zach. You don't get it. You full on fucking don't get it. Sometimes Katana fleet shows up and it's the Empire and they built it and Palpatine's back. Okay, fine. Good. It's actually okay. Better than this. But the fucking other thing that I wanted to fucking throw up in there is that, you know what else is the... Oh, no. Back about Rebel Moon. There's a fucking... Their warp drive is like a vagina in space. It's 100% like a George O'Keefe painting that you're like, that is the space vagina. It just opened up. But they're not like saying anything about it. They just like have it happen. And I'm like, you can't... Okay. This is one of those other things, right?
Can I go uncommented?
Yeah, well, like fucking Dune figured this out, right? Like that if you want your fucking whole story to be about a big space vagina or a big space dick, that's just what it's about, right? Like you say, draw a poster for Dune and it's a fucking sandworm or a sandworm mouth. There's no fucking other thing you can draw. You're like, oh yeah, a fucking like spice harvesting station and a carryall. No, idiot, a Chris knife. Yeah,
Brad Murray rolls up his sleeves and goes, what?
No, it's easy. Watch this. No, audience, you're wrong. See how easy that was?
Yeah. But yes, it's like the whole fucking thing, right? And obviously, it's like, no, Zack Snyder, please don't. okay, you really need to fucking figure out what themes you're doing before you do any of this shit, because there's just so much shit in there. When they were like, oh, yeah, I'm a pacifist samurai droid pacifist because I was a fucking slave droid, a pledge to the true empress's daughter, who you look exactly like, and I vowed not to kill after she died. I'm like, okay, you just described a whole other movie. You need to stop. You need to pump the brakes. But the thing that I also thought was that the judge is also the diametric opposite of an Ewok.
He is.
Because it's like, I was just thinking that those are the two directions you can go, right? Because the fucking xenomorph, if the judge is like fat and hideously white, the xenomorph is razor thin and like inky metallic black. If the judge is tall and hairless, what's an Ewok? Short and fuzzy. There you go. Knocked it out. We've managed to, by dialectical.
I can hear it in Richard Poe's voice as he's like quixotically looking at this Ewok and he goes, I neither yub nor yub.
Or Dee Dee. God. But yes, I fucking, like, conclusion.
Yeah, when he gives, there's a moment where he gives the speech, and it's the apex of the realization that he operates on a fundamentally different operating system than the rest of us do. Mm-hmm. This is supposed to be the final moment of separation, that we are as distant from him as we are from God.
Or birds, or whatever other things that he's described as hating.
Yeah. And there's no way to tame him. And if you're around him, he's going to try to consume you. That's the thesis of what he's issued at these people, which is, you will obey and follow me into my very profane ends, or I'll destroy you because you're a threat to that. And that's what he was communicating. In walks this fucking yokel. There's like, never before has there been a more coherent or elegant defense of the necessity of war. Holy shit! Is that a red flag? Don't ever let this person see anything that isn't like a LinkedIn profile picture of it.
Yeah, I was fucking thinking that you need to fucking expose that dude to like Care Bears, right? Where they just say like, it's nice when people are nice, and he'd be like, yeah, you know, there's some truth to that.
This is a dude whose entire bibliography is Hideo Kojima games.
Well, I don't even fucking think so, because I think they can say more complexity than that shit. I don't know. I feel like that, like, yeah, listening to the judge talk and being taking up a pro-judge position is like, you're in the fucking, like, mollusks off the pier category. You're like, oh no, you can no longer be communicated ideas in a hominid manner, right?
Yeah, that's a good way to think of it. Yeah, and this permeates all sorts of media where Star Wars is very useful for children to grapple with devil's advocacy, because there are appealing things about like the Empire and whatnot, but like the cold hard facts is they built a giant ball to kill people with. Mm-hmm. And allowing a child to be like, to parse the complexity of what they like about the Empire and then rationalize that it can have some things that you like while also going, you can't just fucking blow up planets, dude. Right, like that's a good mental exercise, but you'll always get somebody who, like, in their 40s is still posting, being like, so Alderaan was an atrocity, but you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. My defense of the Empire.
Well, and the fucking thing about Darth Vader is that he's fucking, like, pernicious and hateful and, like, not consistent, right? That he is just, no, he's not a man of honor. He's a fucking kind of despicable piece of shit, right? Like, that's what the whole, like, I've altered the bargain, pray I don't alter it any further means. He's not fucking this, like, noble samurai guy. He is just an asshole. his word is my bond. Idiot.
And we wonder why his grandson, who idolized him, threw temper tantrums all the time. And I use Star Wars because it's the one that we're probably all most familiar with. But you've encountered somebody who had that Lolita or that Blood Meridian reading, and you get kind of a nervous laugh, like, ha, please don't elaborate.
It's in the category of, no, you don't have to hand it to ISIS. When the big villain gives their speech, you don't have to, like, nod along, right? You're like... Actually, yeah, I can just say imperialism is bad. There we go. We did it. Fucking, like, you should not be allowed to
Jones, then it's a complex question. Colonialism, Indiana Jones and colonialism, like a teenager's Facebook relationship status. It's complicated.
Yep. And on that note, I think we are going to head off. In the description for this episode, there will be a link to all of our socials, but most importantly, the Discord. The Discord is where you can hang out, you can talk to us, you can ask us about these things, you can ask other people about these things. MJ posts up places where you can submit your writing for money.
Mm-hmm.
But even more importantly than that, there are cat pictures. And you know how you get more cat pictures? You donate to the Ko-fi. It'll also be in that Linktree link. And every time you donate, we will throw you up some more cat pictures, assuming you don't like bombard us with stuff. Otherwise, we might just release one really, really premium one for like a bundle of donations. But we're not at that rate yet. Of course, it would help us out a great deal.
Meow unboxing videos. That's in our future, baby.
Mm-hmm. On God, we should at some point do the meow mukbang thing where you head down to the butcher shop and get some like chicken livers and a cracked egg and just like record the kitty obliterating that shit. But yes, it would also help us out a great deal if you could maybe send this episode to a friend or just leave a review, leave a like, whatever service you're listening to. This on, if it has any kind of interface that says, gee, this wasn't a waste of my like hour and 8 minutes, that would be of great help to us. But above all else, we hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.